This double act with Lala began about 20 years ago when we were promoting one of my books, and I got laryngitis. You may see symptoms of it still, but it's mostly gone. I was fortunate to be travelling with a trained actress, and she stepped into the breach when I got laryngitis and read passages from my books for me, and then I stepped in afterwards to croak out answers to questions. It worked so well that we've carried on doing that for all my subsequent books, and we're going to do it today, reading not exactly alternate passages, but sharing out the reading. W.B. Yeats is perhaps my favourite poet. It's fashionable to prefer the poems of his maturity, but when I was young, I loved the young Yeats, the wild, mythically charged poems of the Celtic twilight. You might expect me to hate the mysticism and the fairies. After all, it's only fiction, though. And in a way, I do hate them. But the language is so hypnotic, so seductive, that I can't resist it, especially his early collection of poems called The Wind Among the Reeds. I've chosen 8 short poems, which I'm just going to read in sequence from The Wind Among the Reeds, a sequence in which the lover speaks, usually in tones of lovesick despair, which matched my own mood when I was first introduced to these beautiful poems in my early 20s by my father. The lover mourns for the loss of love. Pale brows, still hands, and dim hair. I had a beautiful friend and dreamed that the old despair would end in love in the end. She looked in my heart one day and saw your image was there. She has gone weeping away. He reproves the curlew. O curlew, cry no more in the air or only to the water in the west, because your crying brings to my mind passion-dimmed eyes and long, heavy hair that was shaken out over my breast. There is enough evil in the crying of wind. To his heart, bidding it have no fear. Be you still, trembling heart. Remember the wisdom out of the old days. Him who trembles before the flame and the flood and the winds that blow through the starry ways, let the starry winds and the flame and the flood cover over and hide, for he has no part with the lonely, majestical multitude. He tells of a valley full of lovers. I dreamed that I stood in a valley and amid sighs, for happy lovers passed 2 by 2 where I stood. And I dreamed my lost love came stealthily out of the wood, with her cloud-pale eyelids falling on dream-dimmed eyes. I cried in my dream, O women, bid the young men lay their heads on your knees and drown their eyes with your hair, or remembering hers, they will find no other face fair, till all the valleys of the world have been withered away. He hears the cry of the sedge. I wander by the edge of this desolate lake, where wind cries in the sedge, until the axle break that keeps the stars in their round, and hands hurl in the deep the banners of east and west, and the girdle of light is unbound. Your breast will not lie by the breast of your beloved in sleep. The lover pleads with his friends for old friends. Though you are in your shining days, voices among the crowd and new friends busy with your praise, be not unkind or proud, but think about old friends the most. Time's bitter flood will rise, your beauty perish and be lost for all eyes but these eyes. He thinks of his past greatness when a part of the constellations of heaven. I have drunk ale from the country of the young and weep because I know all things now. I have been a hazel tree and they hung the pilot star and the crooked plough among my leaves in times out of mind. I became a rush that horses tread. I became a man, a hater of the wind, knowing one out of all things alone that his head may not lie on the breast, nor his lips on the hair of the woman that he loves until he dies. O beast of the wilderness, bird of the air, must I endure your amorous cries? A more cynical, some might say more adult and realistic approach to sexual love is expressed in this sonnet by Edna St. Vincent Millay, I, being born a woman and distressed.
I, being born a woman and distressed by all the needs and notions of my kind, am urged by your propinquity to find your person fair and feel a certain zest to bear your body's weight upon my breast. So subtly is the fume of life designed to clarify the pulse and cloud the mind and leave me once again undone, possessed. Think not for this, however, the poor treason of my stout blood against my staggering brain. I shall remember you with love, or season my scorn with pity. Let me make it plain. I find this frenzy insufficient reason for conversation when we meet again.
Eleven members of the Dawkins family attended Balliol College, Oxford. In the late 19th century, Balliol became notorious for a series of scurrilous verses in which named members of the college were lampooned. The most famous of these is Balliol Rhymes, is the one about the college's master, Benjamin Jowett. First come I, my name is Jowett. There's no knowledge, but I know it. I am master of this college. What I don't know isn't knowledge. My great-great-uncle, C.E., later Sir Clinton Dawkins, was at Balliol at that time. The rhyme immortalising him is not as witty as the Jowett one, but I find it interesting as it suggests that atheists were not as rare in Victorian times as one might have supposed. Positivists ever talk in such an epic style as Dawkins. Creeds are naught and man is all. Spell him with a capital. The following poem by Hilaire Belloc, it's about the Boer War, is nostalgic of the time my grandfather was at Balliol, rather than my own time, but I still find it deeply moving. To the Balliol men still in Africa. Years ago, when I was at Balliol, Balliol men, and I was one, swam together in winter rivers, wrestled together under the sun. And still in the heart of us, Balliol, Balliol, loved already but hardly known, welded us, each of us, into the others, called a levy and chose her own. Here is a house that armors a man with the eyes of a boy in the heart of a ranger, and a laughing way in the teeth of the world, and a holy hunger and thirst for danger. Balliol made me, Balliol fed me. Whatever I had, she gave me again. And the best of Balliol loved and led me. God be with you, Balliol men. I've said it before and I say it again. There was treason done and a false word spoken, and England under the dregs of men and bribes about and a treaty broken. But angry, lonely, hating it still, I wished to be there in spite of the wrong. My heart was heavy for Cumnor Hill and the hammer of galloping all day long. galloping outward into the weather, hands are ready and battle in all, words together and wine together and song together in Balliol Hall. Rare and single, noble and few, oh, they have wasted you over the sea, the only brothers ever I knew, the men that laughed and quarrelled with me. Balliol made me, Balliol fed me, whatever I had she gave me again, and the best of Balliol loved and led me. God be with you, Balliol men. Another favourite poet, like Yeats, introduced to me by my father, is A.E. Houseman, and it seems right to have some Houseman here in the neighbouring county to Shropshire. Well, I've been told the terrible story, I hope it's not true, that Houseman didn't actually visit Shropshire, at least until after he'd begun writing A Shropshire Lad. The blue remembered hills were visible to him from Worcestershire.
Into my heart an air that kills from yon far country blows. What are those blue remembered hills? What spires? What farms are those? That is the land of lost content. I see it shining plain, the happy highways where I went, and cannot come again.
With rue my heart is laden, for golden friends I had, for many a rose-lipped maiden, many a light-foot lad. By brooks too broad for leaping, the light-foot boys are laid, the rose-lip girls are sleeping in fields where roses fade. When I came last to Ludlow, amidst the morning pale, two friends kept step beside me, two honest friends and hale. Now Dick lies long in churchyard, and Ned lies long in jail, and I come home to Ludlow amidst the moonlight pale.
Think no more, lad. Laugh, be jolly. Why should men make haste to die? Empty heads and tongues are talking, make the rough road easy walking, and the feather pate of folly bears the falling sky. Oh, 'tis jesting, dancing, drinking, spins the heavy world around. If young hearts were not so clever, oh, they would be young forever. Think no more, 'tis only thinking lays lads underground.
Well, Houseman, of course, is very easy to parody. The best I know is by Hugh Kingsmill. What, still alive at 22? A clean, upstanding chap like you? Sure, if your throat is hard to slit, slit your girls and swing for it. Like enough, you won't be glad when they come to hang you, lad. But bacon's not the only thing that's cured by hanging from a string. So when the spilt ink of the night spreads o'er the blotting pad of light, lads whose job is still to do shall wet their knives and think of you. The following poem is not from A Shropshire Lad, but it has much the same feeling about it. I think it's probably my favourite Houseman poem. Tell me not here. It needs not saying what tune the enchantress plays in aftermaths of soft September or under blanching maize. For she and I were long acquainted, and I knew all her ways. On russet floors by water's idle, the pine lets fall its cone. The cuckoo shouts all day at nothing in leafy dells alone. And traveller's joy beguiles in autumn hearts that have lost their own. On acres of the seeded grasses, the changing burnish heaves. or marshalled under moons of harvest, stand still all night the sheaves, or beeches strip in storms for winter and stain the wind with sheaves, with leaves. Possess, as I possessed a season, the countries I resign, where over elmy plains the highway would mount the hills and shine, and full of shade the pillared forest would murmur and be mine. For nature, heartless, witless nature, will neither care nor know what stranger's feet may find the meadow and trespass there and go, nor ask, amid the dews of morning, if they are mine or no. My great hero among modern Darwinians was W.D. Hamilton, arguably the greatest Darwinian since Darwin. I was thrilled when he published a wonderfully positive review of my first book, The Selfish Gene. In his review, he quoted two poems, including this one from A Shropshire Lad.
From far, from eve and morning, and yon 12-winded sky, the stuff of life to knit me blew hither. Here am I. Now, for a breath I tarry, nor yet disperse apart. Take my hand, quick, and tell me, what have you in your heart? Speak now, and I will answer. How shall I help you? Say, ere to the wind's 12 quarters I take my endless way.
Later, when I got to know Bill Hamilton better as an Oxford colleague, he reminded me of Hausmann's melancholy protagonist. He was very much the same kind of character, and I believe Hausmann was his favourite poet. The second poem Bill quoted in his review of The Selfish Gene was a fragment from Wordsworth's Prelude, the part where he reminisced about his Cambridge days.
And from my pillow, looking forth by light of moon or favouring stars, I could behold the antechapel where the statue stood of Newton, with his prism and silent face, the marble index of a mind forever voyaging through strange seas of thought, alone.
My father also introduced me to Rupert Brooke, and this next poem chimed perfectly with me in my romantic youthful time.
Breathless, we flung us on the windy hill, laughed in the sun and kissed the lovely grass. You said, through glory and ecstasy we pass. Wind, sun and earth remain, the birds sing still. When we are old. And when we die, all's over that is ours, and life burns on through other lovers, other lips, said I. Heart of my heart, our heaven is now, is one. We are earth's best that learnt her lesson here. Life is our cry. We have kept the faith, we said. We shall go down with unreluctant tread, rose-crowned into the darkness. Proud we were, and laughed that had such brave, true things to say. And then you suddenly cried and turned away.
My second Rupert Brooke poem is a great favourite of my father, a lovely, gentle takedown of religion. Heaven. Fish, fly replete in depth of June, dawdling away their watery noon, ponder deep wisdom, dark or clear, each secret fishy hope or fear. Fish say they have their stream and pond, but is there anything beyond? This life cannot be all, they swear, for how unpleasant if it were. One may not doubt that somehow good shall come of water and of mud. And sure, the reverent eye must see a purpose in liquidity. We darkly know, by faith we cry, the future is not wholly dry. Mud unto mud, death eddies near. Not here the appointed end, not here, but somewhere, beyond space and time, is wetter water, slimier slime. And there, they trust, there swimmeth one who swam ere rivers were begun, immense of fishy form and mind, squamous, omnipotent and kind. And under that almighty fin, the littlest fish may enter in. Oh, never fly conceals a hook, fish say, in the eternal brook. But more than mundane weeds are there, and mud celestially fair, fat caterpillars drift around, and paradisal grubs are found. Unfading moths, immortal flies, and the worm that never dies. And in that heaven, of all their wish, there shall be no more land, say fish. I had the good fortune, unlike my father, to live at a time when young men were not sent off to war. Fighting Hitler was a special case, but the First World War was a ridiculous farce. Rupert Brooke died too early to realize it, or he surely would have joined Wilfred Owen, Siegfried Sassoon, and the other great anti-war poets of that time. Here is one of the best by Sassoon.
Aftermath. Have you forgotten yet? For the world's events have rumbled on since those gagged days, like traffic checked a while at the crossing of city ways. And the haunted gap in your mind has filled with thoughts that flow like clouds in the lit heavens of life, and you're a man reprieved to go, taking your peaceful share of time with joy to spare. But the past is just the same, and war's a bloody game. Have you forgotten yet? Look down and swear by the slain of the war that you'll never forget. Do you remember the dark months you held the sector at Mammoth's? The nights you watched and wired and dug and piled sandbags on parapets? Do you remember the rats and the stench of corpses rotting in front of the front-line trench? And dawn coming dirty white and chill with a hopeless rain? Do you ever stop and ask, is it all going to happen again? Do you remember that hour of din before the attack? And the anger, the blind compassion that seized and shook you then as you peered at the doomed and haggard faces of your men? Do you remember the stretcher cases lurching back with dying eyes and lolling heads? Those ashen grey masks of the lads who once were keen and kind and gay? Have you forgotten yet? Look up and swear by the green of the spring that you'll never forget.
To get things in proportion, a poem by Sarah Teasdale, There Will Come Soft Rains.
There will come soft rain and the smell of the ground and swallows circling with their shimmering sound. And frogs in the pools singing at night, and wild plum trees in tremulous white. Robins will wear their feathery fire, whistling their whims on a low fence wire. And not one will know of the war, Not one will care at last when it is done. Not one would mind, neither bird nor tree, if mankind perished utterly. And spring herself, when she woke at dawn, would scarcely know that we were gone.
After that, I feel we need something lighter. I love the witty rhymes of Hilaire Belloc's cautionary tales for children. This one is about George, who played with a dangerous toy and suffered a catastrophe of considerable dimensions. When George's grandmama was told that George had been as good as gold, she promised in the afternoon to buy him an immense balloon. And so she did. But when it came, it got into the candle flame, and being of a dangerous sort, exploded with a loud report. The lights went out, the windows broke, the room was filled with reeking smoke, and in the darkness shrieks and yells were mingled with electric bells, and falling masonry, and groans, and crunching as of broken bones, and dreadful shrieks when, worst of all, the house itself began to fall. It tottered, shuddering to and fro, then crashed into the street below, which happened to be Savile Row. When help arrived, among the dead were Cousin Mary, little Fred, the footman, both of them, the groom, the man that cleaned the billiard room, the chaplain and the stillroom maid, and I am dreadfully afraid that Monsieur Champignon, the chef, will now be permanently deaf, and both his aides are much the same. While George, who was in part to blame, received, you will regret to hear, a nasty lump behind the ear. Moral. The moral is that little boys should not be given dangerous toys. Science is my great love, and science ought to be the inspiration for great poetry. So it is, but mostly prose poetry. For me, the master of scientific prose poetry is Carl Sagan. Here's his famous Pale Blue Dot passage.
Look again at that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner. How frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that, in glory and triumph, they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. The Earth is the only world known so far to harbour life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit, yes. Settle? Not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot. The only home we've ever known.
Or listen to this, the opening and then the last paragraph of Peter Atkins's Creation Revisited.
I shall take your mind on a journey. It is a journey of comprehension, taking us to the edge of space, time, and understanding. On it, I shall argue that there is nothing that cannot be understood, that there is nothing that cannot be explained, and that everything is extraordinarily simple. When we have dealt with the values of the fundamental constants by seeing that they are unavoidably so and have dismissed them as irrelevant, we shall have arrived at complete understanding. Fundamental science then can rest. We are almost there. Complete knowledge is just within our grasp. Comprehension is moving across the face of the earth like the sunrise.
I indulge myself the occasional purple passage. The following from Unweaving the Rainbow would, I suppose, qualify as a certain kind of prose poetry. On a moonless night, when the stars look very cold about the sky, and the only clouds to be seen are the glowing smudges of the Milky Way, go out to a place far from streetlight pollution, lie on the grass, and gaze up at the sky. Because of light's finite speed, when you look at the great galaxy in Andromeda, you are seeing it as it was 2.3 million years ago, and Australopithecus stalked the high veld. You're looking back in time. Shift your eyes a few degrees to the nearest bright star in the constellation of Andromeda, and you see Mirac, but much more recently, as it was when Wall Street crashed. The sun, when you witness its colour and shape, is only 8 minutes ago. But point a large telescope at the Sombrero Galaxy, and you behold a trillion suns as they were when your tailed ancestors peered shyly through the canopy, and India collided with Asia to raise the Himalayas. A collision on a larger scale between two galaxies in Stefan's quintet is shown to us at a time when on Earth dinosaurs were dawning and the trilobites fresh dead. The title of that book, Unweaving the Rainbow, comes from John Keats, his following passage. Do not all charms fly at the mere touch of cold philosophy? There was an awful rainbow once in heaven. We know her woof, her texture. She is given in the dull catalogue of common things. Philosophy will clip an angel's wings, conquer all mysteries by rule and line, empty the haunted air and nomad mine, unweave a rainbow, as it erewhile made the tender person Lamia melt into a shade. I suppose with his training as a doctor, John Keats could be described as a scientist, but not a scientific poet, although undeniably a great poet. My argument in the book was the exact opposite of Keats's. Newton's unweaving of the rainbow increased rather than decreased the poetry and the beauty. I made use of Keats's Ode to a Nightingale in a different argument in the same book. I was making the case, first made jointly with my colleague John Krebs, that animal signals are best seen as manipulating other animals rather than informing them. I compared birdsong to a drug, acting directly on the nervous system of other birds. The nightingale song acted like a drug on Keats. Keats was not a bird, but it would not be surprising if his brain, another vertebrate brain, responded to drugs in the same way as a nightingale's brain. I generalized the point to cover all animal communication signals as what I called extended phenotypes, acting manipulatively on the nervous systems of other animals. Ode to a Nightingale is a long poem. Lala's going to read the first and the sixth verse.
My heart aches, and a drowsy numbness pains my sense, as though of hemlock I had drunk, or emptied some dull opiate to the drains 1 minute past, and leafy woods had sunk. 'Tis not through envy of thy happy lot, but being too happy in thine happiness, that thou, light-winged dryad of the trees, in some melodious plot of beech and green and shadows numberless, singest of summer in full-throated ease. Darkling I listen, and for many a time I have been half in love with easeful death, called him soft names in many a mused rhyme, to take into the air my quiet breath. Now, more than ever, seems it rich to die, to cease upon the midnight with no pain, while thou art pouring forth thy soul abroad in such an ecstasy. Still wouldst thou sing, and I have ears in vain to thy high requiem become a sod.
I adore John Betjeman. I love love his quiet affection for traditional English things. I quoted his Our Padre on the first page of The God Delusion. I was talking of my own affection for a chaplain at my school who had served in the RAF during the war. Our sport during lessons was to sidetrack him away from scripture and towards stirring tales of fighter command and the few. Our Padre is an old sky pilot. Severely now they've clipped his wings, but still the flagstaff in the rectory garden points to higher things. Still he has got a hearty handshake, still he wears his medals and a stole. His voice would reach to heaven and make the Rock of Ages roll. He's too sincere to join the high church, worshipping idols for the Lord. And though the lowest church is my church, Our Padre's broad. Our Padre is an old sky pilot. He's tied a reef knot round my heart. We'll be rocked up to heaven on a rare old tune. Come on, take part. Pull for the shore, sailor, pull for the shore. Heed not the raging billow, bend to the oar. Bend to the oar before the Padre, proud with the Padre rowing stroke. Good old Padre, God for the services, row like smoke. But Betjeman wasn't always affectionate. He could be biting, too. His In Westminster Abbey is almost savage. Quite apart from the racism, classism, and so on, there's the selfishness which I fear typifies private prayer.
Let me take the other glove off, as the Vox Humana swells, and the beauteous fields of Eden bask beneath the abbey bells. Here, where England's statesmen lie, listen to a lady's cry. Gracious Lord, oh, bomb the Germans, spare their women for thy sake, and if that is not too easy, we will pardon thy mistake. But, gracious Lord, whate'er shall be, don't let anyone bomb me. Keep our empire undismembered, guide our forces by thy hand. Gallant blacks from far Jamaica, Honduras, and Togoland. Protect them, Lord, in all their fights, and even more, protect the whites. Think of what our nation stands for. Books from boots and country lanes, free speech, free passes, class distinction, democracy and proper drains. Lord, put beneath thy special care 189 Cadogan Square. Although, dear Lord, I am a sinner, I have done no major crime. Now I'll come to evening service whensoever I have for time. So, Lord, reserve me for a crown, and do not let my shares go down. I will labour for thy kingdom, help our lads to win the war, send white feathers to the cowards, join the Women's Army Corps, then wash the steps around thy throne in the eternal safety zone. Now I feel a little better. What a treat to hear thy word, where the bones of leading statesmen have so often been interred. And now, dear Lord, I cannot wait, because I have a luncheon date.
Perhaps the speaker in this next poem is the daughter of the woman in the previous one, Hunter Trials. It's awfully bad luck on Diana. Her ponies are swallowed, their bits. She fished down their throats with a spanner and frightened them all into fits. So now she's attempting to borrow. Do lend her some, Mummy, do. I'd lend her my own for tomorrow, but today I'll be wanting them too. Just look at Prunella on Guzzle, the wizardest pony on earth. Why doesn't she slacken his muzzle and tighten the breech in his girth? I say, Mummy, there's Mrs. Geezer, and doesn't she look pretty sick? I bet it's because Mona Lisa was hit on the hock with a brick. Miss Blewett says Monica threw it, but Monica says it was Joan, and Joan's very thick with Miss Blewett, so Monica's sulking alone. And Margaret failed in her paces, her withers got tied in a noose, so her coronet's caught in the traces, and now all her fetlocks are loose. Oh, it's me now. I'm terribly nervous. I wonder if Smudges will shy. She's practically certain to swerve as her pelham is over one eye. Oh, wasn't it naughty of Smudges? Oh, Mummy, I'm sick with disgust. She threw me in front of the judges, and my silly old collarbone's bust. And now back to Betjeman's affection, and in this case, tragedy. In memory of Basil, Marquis of Dufferin and Avon.
On such a morning as this, with the birds ricocheting their music out of the whelming elms to a copper beech's embrace, and a sifting sound of leaves from multitudinous branches running across the park to a checker of light on the lake. On such a morning as this, with the Times for June the 11th, left with coffee and toast, you opened the breakfast room window and sprawled on the southward terrace said, "That means war in September." Friend of my youth, you are dead, and the long peal pours from the steeple over this sunlit quad in our university city and soaks in Headington stone. Motionless stand the pinnacles under a flying sky, as though they too listened and waited, like me, for your dear return with a Bullingdon noise of an evening in a sports Bugatti from Tame that belonged to a man in Magdalen. Friend of my youth, you are dead, and the quads are empty without you. Then there were people about. Each hour, like an Oxford archway, opened on long green lawns and distant unvisited buildings. And you, my friend, were explorer, and so you remained to me always. Humorous, reckless, loyal. My kind, heavy-lidded companion. Stop, oh, many bells, stop pouring on roses and creeper your unremembering peal. This hollow, unhallowed VE day. I am deaf to your notes and dead by a soldier's body in Burma.
On my 70th birthday, Lala organised a magnificent dinner for me in New College Hall with 100 guests. I wrote a poem for the occasion, reflecting on attaining the biblical span of 70 years, referred to by A.E. Housman in his Cherry Blossom poem. Now of my 70 years, 20 will not come again. And take from 70 springs a score, it only leaves me 50 more. And so on, 50 is not enough time to admire the cherry. I included half a dozen such allusive quotations in my poem, which you'll probably recognise as I read it. From George and Ira Gershwin, from Shakespeare, D.K. Chesterton, The Decent Inn of Death, Andrew Marvel, Time's Winged Chariot Hurrying Near, and Dylan Thomas, Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. Here's my little poem. Now of my 70 years, 70 won't come again. And take from 70 springs the lot, subtraction tells you what I've got. But only if you're so alarmist as to believe the ancient psalmist. For what is said in Holy Writ, I'm one who doesn't care a bit. Away with actuarial mystics, I'll throw my lot with hard statistics. The Bible may be old and quaint, necessarily so, it ain't. I'll go along with George and Ira. Across the reaper's boughs I'll fire a warning shot. I'm not about to let life's umpire give me out, leg before or caught and bowled, at least until I'm really old and reach that bourne, the one we learn, from which no travellers return. That decent inn, no Marriott, presaged by time's winged chariot. Still time to gentle that good night, time to set the world alight, time yet new rainbows to unweave, ere going on eternity leave. Thank you very much. I can't really answer questions on poetry, but I could try. And I am going to sign books afterwards, aren't I think?
Yes.
Yes, good. If there are any questions. Can we have the lights up in the house, maybe?
Evolution is a can be cruel and wicked and tooth and claw and things like that, but your books do not show that, but your books are a sense of awe and wonder and looking at science in a beautiful way. And it's poetical, so it's not surprising that you are here today to do this poetry.
Well, I think poetry works both ways, and you can make poetry out of the red in tooth and claw, as indeed Tennyson did, although he was writing before Darwin. And I have emphasized that aspect of it myself, as Darwin did. Darwin also emphasized the reverse. You can go either way. I think it's poetic anyway, whether you emphasize the ruthlessness of natural selection. It's not just that nature happens to be ruthless. It more or less has to be for natural selection to work. And there is a sort of beauty in it. As Darwin himself said, there is grandeur in this view of life. There is grandeur. When you look at the sinewy elegance of a cheetah or the gazelle that it's pursuing, these are highly mechanized machines which are the product of a long evolutionary arms race between ancestral carnivores and ancestral victims. And the beautiful streamlined shape of both animals has been carved out with the blood, with the deaths, the horrible deaths of numerous ancestors. There is a kind of poetry in it, but it's not a soft, sentimental poetry.
On the matter of evolution, Mr. Erdogan in Turkey has taken evolution out of the school curriculum. I was wondering if you have any observations.
Well, it's an outrage. He's a terrible man anyway, of course, as anybody who knows Turkey will agree. I sort of feel that Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey, whose ideal was secularism and who prized education, Atatürk would be shocked and disgusted. Yes, and Turkey, of course, is just true of the whole Islamic world, that evolution is not taken seriously, except in a few universities. So this is extremely bad news. Fortunately, in America, where similar things have been happening, despite the dreadful election, things are moving in the right direction, educationally speaking, in America.
Thank you for so many old favourites, many of which are favourites of mine. However, I'm interested that your poems seem to be chosen from the last generation's favourites. Have you any poems that you have found written in the last, say, 50 years that have inspired you or that you love?
I find it hard to think of any, actually. I mean, I mentioned Dylan Thomas, and I love Dylan Thomas. Did you say 50 or 15? Okay. I love Dylan Thomas, and it was one of the allusions in my own 70th birthday poem. I'm sure there must be others. I can't think of any at the moment, but I tend to go back to the early 20th century, 19th century on the whole.
My question was almost the same, actually. What about Simon Armitage, Carol Ann Duffy, those people who are in their 50s and 60s now? Do you not enjoy any of their poetry?
I'm just not very familiar with them, I'm sorry to say. It's my loss.
I think it is.
I just wondered if Professor Dawkins would choose one of the poems he read today as his favourite.
Yes. Actually, it's probably the one that I had to leave out for lack of time. Forsaken Garden by Haldane and Charles Swinburne. It's so long that I decided at the last minute that I would have to axe it, but it's a beautiful poem. How much time actually have we? What is the time?
Well, you've got 3 minutes.
I'll just do the first verse. A Forsaken Garden by Swinburne. In a coign of the cliff between lowland and highland, at the sea down's edge between windward and lee, Walled round with rocks as an inland island, the ghost of a garden fronts the sea. A girdle of brushwood and thorn encloses the steep, square slope of the blossomless bed, where the weeds that grew green from the graves of its roses now lie dead. It's probably an exaggeration to say that's my very favourite. I like some of Kipling, which I didn't have time to put in either. I like Yeats, I mentioned as my favourite poet, and read a lot of him. It's very hard to choose.
Gentlemen here.
Thank you very much for your selection of poetry today. Coming over today to this event, I thought one poem which was an absolute certainty was Philip Larkin's Orbaid, and you never mentioned it at all. It's just slightly surprising.
What, sorry?
Philip Larkin's poem, Orbaid, sometimes described as the greatest hymn to atheism, but you never mentioned him, which surprised me, that's all. I just wondered, was
you
he...
You choose your poems, I'll choose mine. But you're right, I do like Philip Larkin, and yes. Okay.
Can I just say something? Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things was that the remit was poems that had sort of influenced Richard, and I think when you go back in your own history, you look at the things that you read when you were younger and earlier. So that may answer the thing about not so much choosing modern poets.
Nice one, thank you.
Yeah, thank you both very much. That was incredibly interesting, and thank you so much for the time you spent thinking out the whole event and the poetry. It was fabulous. We've really enjoyed ourselves. Thank you for coming. I'm going to present you now with our traditional Ledbury Festival gift, which is the bowls, the festival bowls that are made here locally by a local potter called Fleen Doran. Thank you very much, both of you. Thank you.